Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the State Department Inspector General's report delivered to the Congress today that is critical of Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server that she had not sought permission to use. Cybersecurity expert Alan Pala, the director of the SANS Institute, who has testified several times before the House and Senate, joins us to discuss the broader issues involved in this largely partisan manufactured scandal and the irony that Clinton's private server was not hacked, but the State Department's server was. We'll discuss the appalling lack of cybersecurity in all government departments except the FBI, CIA, and NSA, and the unbelievable breach of personal data on all government employees, especially those involved in defense and intelligence, hacked from the Office of Personnel Management by the Chinese. And in an even more unbelievable display of bureaucratic incompetence, the contractor hired to fix cybersecurity at the OPM has suddenly gone out of business and disappeared from the scene. Then we'll examine the broader global rise of Donald Trump-like nativism and right-wing populism and its connection to the shrinking middle class with Branko Milanović, the former lead economist in the World Bank Research Group and author of the new book Global Inequality. He joins us to discuss the awakening brought about by Bernie Sanders of the decades-long rising inequality in America that Milanović calls plutocratic equilibrium, in which the elites purchase political power, then ensure the working class supports the unequal status quo by distracting them with issues like gun control and gay marriage. Then finally, we will speak with Lona Atkinson, the director of the Center for the Study of Voting, Elections and Democracy at the University of New Mexico, about the rally/riot at the Trump event in Albuquerque, which the governor of New Mexico did not attend because she was, quote, really busy. Although Governor Susana Martinez has been touted as a possible vice presidential running mate for Trump to repair his image with women and Hispanics, this did not stop Trump from trashing the head of the Republican Governors Association and blaming her for the state's unemployment and increase in food stamps, as well as accusing her of accepting refugees from Syria, which is a total lie. And joining us now is Alan Pala, the Director of Research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree granting institution and the principal cybersecurity training school. Alan directs SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risk in Cybersecurity study. Alan has testified several times before both the House and the Senate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Pala.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And the State Department's Inspector General's report has come out. Well, it officially comes out tomorrow, but from what we have told about the report, it criticizes Hillary Clinton in a number of areas. But it does also admit that Colin Powell pretty much did the same thing as she has done, and also former U.S. Ambassador to Kenya did the same as well. But the report did criticize the State Department and went on to say that there's a long-standing systemic weakness in handling electronic records that goes well beyond the tenure of any Secretary of State. So my understanding is that the great irony in this story, Alan, is that Hillary Clinton's private server was never hacked, but the State Department server was.
Yes, that's exactly right. The irony here is that people are making a lot of noise about a practice that substantially every member of the cabinet has done since email became widely used, and not focusing on the systemic weaknesses in security that makes her email that is at the State Department neither protected nor private.
So how did this happen? Because it seems to be a government-wide problem. Because we had the scandal at the Office of Personnel Management, the OPM, where it was discovered that the Chinese had hacked in to all of the government files and gotten all the dossiers on government employees. And they probably, and I think it's a reasonable assumption, they focused on those in the Pentagon and in the intelligence services. And frankly, these dossiers tell you everything about these people, about their mortgages, about their, they even have their fingerprints. And I mean, this is
everything you need for for stealing people's identities, exactly.
And what's ever happened about the OPM breach? Obviously, again, it was a contractor that was at fault. So is this a systemic problem that contractors are doing all of this work? Is the OPM thing an isolated incident, to your understanding?
Well, let's look at it from two perspectives. One is, what happened after OPM got hacked? They hired a new contractor, Imperatus, to fix the problem, and just a couple weeks ago, Imperatus disappeared, literally disappeared. They pulled their website off the internet. They completely stopped work. They're gone. And what that reflects is the answer to your first question, which is the systemic problem is that the government doesn't buy defensible systems. In other words, they don't use procurement wisely. They don't ensure the contractors and their employees defend their systems, and they don't verify the security skills of the contractors they hire. So it's a deep problem that needs fixing much more quickly and with much more energy than whether or not the State Department has every document that Secretary Clinton sent.
Well, but when you say that the vendor, the contractor that replaced the contractor who blew it so badly and allowed the Chinese to get all of the dossiers on all government employees, but obviously they were looking for Pentagon and intelligence people, that the replacement simply disappeared. Now, that raises the question of whether the replacement was in fact perhaps even working for a foreign government. How do you just disappear like that?
Well, you disappear when you want to not take any questions from the press and others. So you disappear by just pulling your website. But the reason you go out of business is, I think, a little more interesting, which is most of these contractors, and this is true of this contractor in particular, have a great number of people who call themselves security people, but all they know how to do is admire the problem. And when they get stuck in an actual situation where they have to fix the problem, they have to go recruit people who have real skills, and they find out they're both hard to find and expensive, and that's what puts them out of business.
So how does then, we all got a real glimpse, or a far, rather stark one, I would say, at the incompetence of some of these contractors when Barack Obama launched his single biggest program of his tenure as president and the centerpiece of his legacy, which is so-called Obamacare. When that was finally launched for the public, we all know that it crashed and burned, and we find out that the vendor, I think, came from Canada in this case and was perhaps the lowest bidder, and they simply didn't know what they were doing. So how does the government make its decisions, and how does it assess whether the people they're granting these incredibly important contracts to secure the nation's secrets are competent, capable, and reliable?
Well, to assess whether someone is competent, you actually have to have an assessor who is competent himself. Think about hiring pilots. If you have someone who's never flown a plane, judging whether or not a pilot's going to be any good, he's not going to do it very well. And that's how the government picks people. They have people who have never actually secured a computer system. They may have bought something, but they've never actually done the work. And they're asked to pick contractors and judge their skills. And they get what they deserve, which is essentially people who can talk about the problem but can't fix the problem.
So is this a problem then? Because everything you're telling us, we have to assume that the FBI, the CIA, and in particular the NSA, protect its secrets, notwithstanding the Edward Snowden leaks. But assuming that, and this is, I think, it's a safe assumption, that the NSA is one of the most advanced cyber operations in the world, let's start with the first question. Given the appalling lack of security with the State Department being hacked, with the OPM being hacked, etc., are you, as an expert in this field, confident that the FBI and the CIA can secure their secrets?
They are much better than the other agencies, and that's because they have a critical mass of very skilled people. And so they are the place where the skilled people getting out of school want to work. If you're very good at this, you want to work with other people who are very good, people you can learn from. And places like the State Department, with essentially no hands-on wizards, don't draw wizards. So Yes, I'm confident that the NSA and the FBI have raised very high walls. Now, people are going to get over those walls, but what I like about what's happening at the NSA and the FBI is they've invested as well in the forensics skills, in-house forensic skills, to go find the bad guys quickly and get them out fast. And that's what's completely missing at the other agencies. They're often infected for months or even a year or longer before anyone tells them that they've been infected because they don't have anyone looking because they don't have the skills to look. And they go and try to hire contractors, but they don't get the best contractors, so they don't know where to look.
So is that like what happened with the Sony hack, where the North Koreans were lurking inside of Sony's system for months and months on end, just cherry-picking all the information? Is that the kind of stuff that goes on?
Yeah, it's exactly what goes on. There's a whole field in cybersecurity called continuous monitoring. Not continuous assessment, but actually continuously monitoring the traffic inside your organization. And a small fraction of organizations, the big banks, NSA, FBI, the people who have already figured out what the problem is, and all the commercial organizations who've been hit really hard, they do this regularly. But the State Department doesn't do it. They used to. There was actually a time about 8 years ago when diplomatic security did it well, but they've lost all those good people, and now they're just not doing it anymore.
So, Alan Pallad, then, is it reasonable to suggest that the NSA should be able to give some of its skill or help some of the other agencies who are vulnerable to these hacks?
I know this doesn't play well in Washington, but Australia, much smaller country, asks the people who know how attacks are done, their equivalent of their NSA, it's called ASD, Australian Signals Directorate, they ask them to protect the whole civilian government as well as the Defense Department, and they do an extraordinarily good job for a very small country. So although no one will ever go along with it, I think you need to have people who are competent protecting systems. And right now, the concentration of competence is inside NSA and the military.
So is this a case of turf, not so much a turf battle, but protecting one's own turf?
No, this is a matter of enemies of the state. People believe you'd be giving too much power to an organization like the NSA if you allowed them to protect the systems of civilian agencies.
Right.
I just think you're not protecting the civilian agencies, so you're stuck between a rock and a hard place.
But the suggestion is that the NSA ought to share some of its power and some of its technology or brain power to help these other agencies. And would the resistance come from the NSA? That's my question.
No. The NSA tried to help DHS, and DHS just didn't have enough smart people to know how to put it to work.
And that would have been probably true of OPM as well, right?
Yes.
So this is so extraordinary, Alan. I'm my head spinning here. And, you know, we've got all of, you know, that this is going to be a massive political football, and everybody's going to be talking about it. It'll be the headlines for days. And it's like
silly headlines.
Though. Yeah, but it's sort of like, you know, tossing raw meat to a mad dog. You know,
okay,
Republicans
you're right.
are going to go running away with this. But let's look into this other story that came out today, this Romanian hacker, Guccifer, who was extradited from Romania. He claimed to have hacked into Hillary Clinton's private email server, but nobody believes that's the case. But nevertheless, he managed to hack into Colin Powell's email, members of George W. Bush's family, a former U.S. cabinet member, a former member of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, and a former presidential advisor. I think in that case, that was probably Sid Blumenthal. So this is a broader problem, isn't it, than just government security. Government officials, you can go to their private emails, and then via them, you could perhaps garner some state secrets.
That's right. You have people who use systems that are not secure, but you have them exactly the same inside federal agencies. So I've always felt, in fact, I remember President Clinton actually said this in the first big national meeting on cybersecurity. He said the government should lead by example. And right now, the example that the government is leading with is incompetence. And it needs to switch from talking about the problem to actually fixing the problem. And the reason that works for the rest of the world, meaning you've pointed out that private citizens are vulnerable, or government officials who are acting in a private way are vulnerable. What I'm saying is, if the federal government uses procurement power to push the vendors to deliver safer systems and push the AT&Ts and Verizons to deliver safer networks, those same systems and networks should be available to the rest of us. So it's time for Congress to, if they want to focus on cybersecurity, they should focus on cybersecurity, not whether Hillary stored her email on the wrong system.
But you said earlier that the problem is that the people who are assessing, say, contractors, and you made the analogy that you have a person who's giving out a contract to a pilot who's never flown a plane. Is this also true of those who procure the computer and systems and the internet systems in the first place?
Yes. So right now, when you look at a contract, and you look at federal contracts for cybersecurity, the only thing it requires people to do is write a report about their security. It doesn't require them to fix it. So the contracting language, in fact, when they buy software, they don't ask the software vendors to test the systems for vulnerabilities and deliver those reports prior to delivering the systems, meaning they're not buying smart, and it's time to buy smart.
But do you think the problem, which you alluded to earlier, Alan Powler, is that the smart people have all been sort of hoovered up by the NSA? Is there simply not enough smart people to go around?
There are enough smart people if you focus on procurement, because you can use the experts to get the specifications right. There are not enough people if you spread that procurement out over 1,000 agencies across government. So right now, you've got very thin skills in every agency. But if you localize them and concentrated them, then you could do some good. We tried to do that. I chaired a panel on cyber skills for Janet Napolitano when she was Secretary of DHS, and we recommended that they actually make cybersecurity a profession like contracting, where you could bring in great people and they could support other great people, but they chose to distribute the few people they had. I think they had 5 world-class people at the time. I think it's down to 3 now. But distribute them across the whole agency so there's no critical mass, so there's no draw to bring the people into a concentrated group that could work with NSA to protect the rest of government. I'm going around in circles.
Well, but it sounds like what you told us earlier about the Australian equivalent of the NSA sharing their skills with the entire government and bringing the government up to their standard, that sounds like a good roadmap to follow, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And what's the political support for that? Is there any out there?
No, there isn't. Well, there's an interest on the Hill, but OMB has squelched any focus on actually taking an approach like the one that Australia took. Australia said, here are the 4 things you have to do to stop most of the attacks, and we're going to help you do it. What OMB says is, here are the 3,000 things you should think about. But the people they're asking to think about it don't know enough to pick the 4 that need to be done first, so they go off in many directions and write reports.
So is there anybody then that you can identify that's, obviously we're aware that this has become a silly political scandal along the lines of Benghazi, and that's already operating in effect in an alternative universe. But where are the adults in Washington in terms of this? Because, you know, the constant, you know, leaks that China seems to have just about everything you need to know. And you have to assume that their military intelligence spying is also equal to what they do in terms of economic intelligence by getting secrets from American manufacturers and big corporations. So it's not like we're just waking up to this problem. It's the alarm bells have been ringing for decades.
The alarm bells have been ringing, but when you look for experts in Washington, you get a congregation of problem admirers, meaning you'll set up a council of people to make a difference, and they won't have ever protected a system. They don't know how the attacks work. The fundamental rule in cybersecurity that people who've been attacked understand is offense informs defense. So if you're going to have somebody who tells you what to do, those people have to know exactly how the attacks work. That's what Australia did, by the way. It's the opposite of what the United States did. The United States set a whole bunch of people around a table and said, what's every possible thing you could do to protect a system? And since no one has enough money to do them all, they do the easy things that don't work. What Australia said is, how are the, in this case it was the Chinese, getting into our systems on natural resources? That's what triggered the whole movement in Australia. How are they getting in? How do we stop them and everyone else from getting in? They had to analyze the attacks, and they figured out how the attacks work. They found the kill chain. When they found the kill chain, they figured out what the four. There were only really four things that were needed to stop substantially all of the attacks, and they've been doing it for 7 or 8 years. It's quite impressive.
Well, Alan Pallett, I thank you very much. You've really, I think, opened our eyes a little to the real problems here as we go through all this political theater. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome, Ian. It's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. And again, I've been speaking with Alan Pallett, who's Director of Research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree-granting institution and the principal cybersecurity training school. Alan directs SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the early warning system for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risk in Cybersecurity study. Alan has testified several times before both the House and the Senate. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the broader global rise of Donald Trump-like nativism and right-wing populism and its connection to the shrinking middle class. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Branko Milanović, who's formerly a lead economist in the World Bank Research Group and is now a visiting professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's the author of The Haves and the Have-Nots, A Brief Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality, and his new book, Global Inequality, is just out. Welcome to Background Briefing, Branko Milanović.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
And your new book, Global Inequality, documents the shrinking middle class around the industrialized world, not just in the United States and Britain, but also in more social democratic countries and egalitarian nations like Germany, Sweden, and Australia. So what explains this global shrinkage of the middle class?
Well, I actually am glad that you mentioned, of course, the other nations, because it is indeed true that, of course, you can say that the U.S. is maybe have had, you know, developments which shrank the middle class more than the other countries, but they were not exempt from that either. Countries like Sweden or Germany also experienced the same phenomenon. Now, that leads us to kind of believe, and of course there are empirical studies, that essentially they were exposed to the same forces. Now, these forces could be the forces of technological change or the forces of globalization or even the forces of economic policy, which is then driven essentially by globalization. I do tend to believe that globalization had a lot to do with that, and I also believe that it's very difficult to sort of decide how much was due to technological change, how much to globalization, but of course the jury is still out on that, so there is no unanimity on this.
Well, you have coined the term plutocratic equilibrium, and you argue that the rising inequality in the United States is led not to populism, but to what you call this plutocratic equilibrium, where the elites basically control the Washington. Wall Street seems to run Washington, and the poor are basically excluded, if you will, with the working class encouraged to support politics, but only in the sense that they get distracted by issues like gun control and gay marriage, which is very much the way that this campaign is shaping up with Donald Trump, you know, in this sort of bread and circuses way that he's operating. And, of course, his policy prescriptions are entirely plutocratic, and his tax cuts would cost something like $15 trillion over 10 years. So are we stuck with that paradigm, which we've had for some time now, where we have the government of the 1%, by the 1%, for the 1%? And do you think Bernie Sanders has done anything to reverse that, even though he may not be end up being the person running against Donald Trump?
You know, it's difficult, of course, for me because I have not followed all the vicissitudes or changes in the campaign. But it's difficult, of course, to go and specifically argue what are the weak and strong points of each candidate. But I think what we see broadly, again, it's a phenomenon which I think is much wider than only the U.S., is we see that there is a certain groundswell of populist support which would, in some way, would like to reverse some aspects of globalization. And I think these are the people who feel, rightly or wrongly, that they have been hurt by, you know, great openness, ability to outsource production, and more recently, of course, by migration both in the U.S. and Europe. So these people do find some champions, and generally it has been the case that these were essentially right-wing parties. The irony, of course, is that actually in the U.S., that backlash is led by not only a person who is extremely rich, but whose actually policy prescriptions would, other than sort of vague sort of stories about the reversal of globalization or renegotiating of the trade agreements, would actually in the tax policy make situation even more unequal than it is now. So the plutocratic equilibrium is what I meant is that essentially you had policies that benefit the top, which we have seen quite a lot in the last 20 years, and then you essentially do not, you send small signals or give small things to the bulk of the population and believe that they will not notice that there was a process of enrichment going on the top. Now, that has a little bit changed because I think that the losers have now become more, losers, under quote, have become more aware of the situation.
Well, but I think if you look at the, I know you're not following the politics at the moment, and frankly, I don't blame you. But only a few days ago, Donald Trump spoke to the NRA and talked about getting rid of all kinds of gun control. So in the sense that these plutocratic enablers in politics and in terms of what Trump would represent if he were elected, it is the politics of distraction at the end of the day, is it not? The assumption is that working people in this country and the shrinking middle class somehow won't notice that their standard of living is going down, but they'll get all fired up that somebody's going to take their guns away or that gay people are going to invade the children's bathrooms and et cetera, which seems to be the obsession now with this business over bathrooms.
Well, I totally agree. I think that actually very often it is the politics of distraction, because if you really cannot do something real for the people whose incomes, as we know, have been more broadly stagnant for quite some time, whereas average income has gone up and the income of the top 1% and the income of 5%, top 5% and so on, then, of course, you send these distractions and you talk about, you know, bathroom or you take gun control or you're going to build a wall against Mexico and so on. Now, of course, I think it's very difficult for most people to actually assess some claims that Trump is making, because there seem to be so many of them, and I think there are many of them are contradictory and they change from one day to another, that you're a little bit like chasing always the latest thing, and you may be commenting on what just was happened or said today, but then he might change and say something different or sometimes even contradictory the next day, so you seem to be like permanently sort of behind. So that's why I think it's very difficult to assess individual claims. But just to summarize, I think actually there are these two dangers which I believe exist now. Is one is essentially populism, which would like to reverse globalization, and it has many good sides, so it would be absolutely devastating for incomes of many people if there were some significant reversals. But then there is also a populist equilibrium, which uses some of that dissatisfaction and send distracting signals, as you call them, to the most of the populace.
So given that this plutocratic equilibrium that you talk about, Branko Milanović, has been going on for some decades, and Bernie Sanders, of course, has been running for president and calling for a revolution. And he is, even though he calls himself a democratic socialist, his policies are very much social democratic policies. And so, frankly, I've been covering politics in this country for a long time, and I've never heard this kind of dialogue in the mainstream. So you have to credit Bernie Sanders with, I think, introducing a sort of more, shall we say, broadening the political spectrum, since we've had our politics tend to be entirely concentrated on the right and the center, and there's always been a fairly weak left. Does it strike you as a sort of healthy turn of events that the political debate is broadening a little and the full spectrum of politics as they have in Europe hasn't reached that point, but it's certainly heading in that way? Do you see a change in America, in other words?
Yeah, I would totally agree with you that I think what Bernie has done is actually he has definitely broadened the spectrum. I must say that the first time that I listened to him, which was probably, I would say, I don't know, maybe 12 months ago or maybe 18 months ago, that was his, you know, speech about inequality and the Wall Street and, you know, accumulation of wealth and all that. And I was just totally, you know, shocked. I found it striking that actually such a sort of a very powerful speech, it was actually seen by many people on YouTube and so on, and it was certainly not part of the usual mainstream at all. And it's extremely, I think satisfactory, and actually it is a very good development that it has now become, if not the mainstream, it certainly has become accepted by a very large percentage of population. So it has really entered the discourse, and I don't think it's going to be dislodged from that position for a while, whether it is Bernie who continues or somebody else, we shall see. But certainly this social democratic approach has been really a very good news, I think, for the American political life. I mean, ironically, I think that actually by having Bernie and having this kind of a left alternative in the U.S., U.S. political spectrum, it seems to me, for example, is now broader than it is in France, where we basically have, extreme right wing, we have center right, and we have a centrist party. And really, we don't have much on the left anymore.
So, well, of course, that is, I think, one of the strange things about the politics both here and in the United States is the duopolies are disappearing or eroding. The duopoly here being the Democratic mm-hmm. Party and the right. Republican Party duopoly. After all, Bernie Sanders is not even a Democrat. He's a self-described Democratic Socialist, and it's hard to figure out what kind of Republican Donald Trump is. And then you right. have the same thing in Europe, where the duopolies between the Socialists and the Conservatives seem to be right. breaking down. So what would you describe this other than a kind of resurgent populism?
You know, this is, I mean, factually, if you look at what happened again more recently, Spain is a very good example where both of the major parties, you know, Popular Party, center-right, and then Socialist Party, center-left, have definitely lost lots of votes, and were unable to form government. They could have formed government together, but they, of course, cannot work with each other. But in any case, the sort of a duopoly which existed in Spain in the past is now gone. And that's why we have new elections in June. Then, of course, even more extremely is the situation with the election of the president in Austria, where neither of the two major parties had a candidate in the second round. So things are definitely, I think, changing. Now, the dangerous part and the good part is what we don't know what will happen in the future. The dangerous part could be that you have sort of extremist parties that become stronger, parties of the extreme right, the anti-immigrant, xenophobic, or whatever. So that would be really bad development. The more hopeful development is that if you had broadening of the political spectrum, if you had more social democratic parties, and if you had an attempt to change policies in the way that would really benefit majority of the population. So we don't know how this will eventually play out. So there is, I think, a dangerous part, but there is also a very hopeful one.
So just returning to the United States and the current situation in terms of what the competition between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, which of course we're very aware of out here in California. For the first time ever, California is suddenly relevant in their primaries.
That's true.
But they're both campaigning very hard out here. But you know, the mathematics are pretty much against Bernie. It's an uphill climb to get the kind of votes that he would need. But clearly, he's going to have some influence at the Democratic convention, particularly if they can get the head of the DNC, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, out of the way. But what do you think at the end of the day is Bernie's contribution? We know that there's a movement that he's created and it could continue after this election, but it just is specifically in terms of how much he's moved Hillary Clinton to the left. And do you see her bringing in the Rubens and the Summers back? It seems to me that she won't be able to at least do that.
Yeah, well, let me put it in general terms, because it's, I think, difficult for, you know, for people who are not insiders in politics to know what will happen in concrete instances, whether some people would come back or not. But I think in general terms, Bernie has absolutely broadened the debate. He has introduced a new aspect which was really on the fringes in the past, and not only in the recent past, but we're talking about probably 30 years. And in that sense, he has actually made huge contribution. However, that contribution needs to continue. In other words, it has to be implemented. It has to be carried over not only by Bernie, but other people. So it has to become part, as it were, of establishment of a sort of a potentially, you know, option that can be voted in and that can actually come to power, whether it would be with him or with somebody else, as is more likely. So I think in that sense, it is really a major contribution. Now, whether the presumed candidate, I mean, Hillary, who is probably most likely will be the Democratic candidate, whether she would be in her policies swayed very much by that, I'm not quite sure about that. But because once you become president, of course, you know, the past is the past. So you essentially have to deal with the Congress as it is and with people as they are and the Wall Street and others. So I'm not sure how much in the future that would have an influence even over a Democratic president. But, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that she would be actually influenced. But as I said, I'm more cautious on that. I see the contribution more over the medium term than immediately for the next after the next election.
Well, Branko Milanovic, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks a lot. It was really a pleasure, as always.
Well, thank you, Branko. And again, I've been speaking with Branko Milanovic, who's formerly a lead economist in the World Bank Research Group and is now a visiting professor at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and is the author of The Haves and Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality. And his latest book just out is Global Inequality. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the rally/riot at the Trump event in Albuquerque. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lona Atkison, who is a professor and Regents Lecturer in the Political Science Department at the University of New Mexico, where she teaches courses on political behavior, public opinion, and elections. She's also the director of the Center for the Study of Voting, Elections, and Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lona Atkison.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And there was a fairly lively rally, shall we say, in Albuquerque yesterday with clashes between pro-Trump, Donald Trump supporters and those that are opposed to him, many of whom were carrying Mexican flags, rocks were thrown, arrests were made. So, and of course, today here in the Southland, in Southern California, we have a rally going on down in Anaheim where it's not quite as violent, but the same folks are arrayed against each other. So I guess it's safe to say this Republican presidential candidate is a polarizing figure.
That's right. And, you know, do we want to call these rallies or riots? Right. You know, what's the when do they cross over? Certainly the New Mexico, the Albuquerque incident looks a little bit like a riot with the tear gas and the violence going on outside.
But what went on inside was pretty extraordinary, and that is that Donald Trump gave up a very blistering attack on Governor Susana Martinez, who's a two-term Hispanic governor of New Mexico and the nation's first Hispanic female governor. What I found extraordinary, Lana, was that she has been named in various lists as a possible Trump vice presidential candidate because he has such manifest problems with the Latino vote and with women. So she'd be like a twofer, you know?
And yeah, she'd be a great candidate.
Right. But so why did he insult her?
Well, I mean, I think it's a sort of two-way street there. I mean, obviously there are clear problems between the governor and the party's presidential nominee. I mean, she's come out actively and said some things against him in terms of his policies, that she doesn't agree with him, especially about the wall, and of course his remarks about Mexicans, I mean, which are horrible. So, yeah, she's come out sort of actively against those. Yet she has not, you know, come out and said, I won't support him. So she's really walking this fine line, but yesterday seems to have moved it over into a new place, right? Because they didn't meet. She wasn't there. She wasn't present. You know, I think this is a serious problem. This is a serious problem for the governor and for the Republican Party and for Donald Trump. You know, he needs to at least be meeting with these people to discuss things, to bring the party together, and they should want to meet with him to move him into a position where they feel more comfortable with him. No dialogue leads to conflict and hostility and promotes it, and dialogue decreases it. So the fact that both of them have sort of drawn these lines in the sand and they're not communicating seems really, like continuous problems for the Republican Party as they move into the summer campaign.
Well, to be fair to Governor Martinez, though, no local political official from New Mexico appeared on the stage with Donald Trump. Now, of course, she's told the local reporters that she was really busy. And apparently the remarks that Trump apparently is upset about were expressed in a recent closed-door party gathering. So do you think, what is it that's bothering Trump? Because, you know, this is not, as I say, it seems counterintuitive to attack somebody that might actually be a good running mate, number one. But it also, it sort of reminds me of the criticism of Trump from the former host of The Daily Show, Jon Stewart, who's referred to him as a man baby, so that he's sort of having a tantrum. Because his demeaning remarks about her was that she wasn't doing her job, and he blamed her for the influx of Syrian refugees into the state of New Mexico, which simply hasn't happened. So,
yes.
So, I mean,
yes. He lashes out, and that, you know, certainly my remarks were meant about the fact that the two of them aren't communicating together. Of course, if the Republican governor doesn't have time for the party nominee, the presidential party nominee, it's really not surprising that no other Republicans in the state have time for him either, right, to be on stage. He's the leader of the Republican Party in the state. The problem is that the party, right, that these are visible signs of the fact that the party is continuing to collapse, right, that they're not working through these issues, that they're not coming together as they need to, and that they're not providing a forum for themselves, right, to deal with these issues. Now, you know, why does he do that? I agree. You know, he lashes out at anyone who he feels is attacking him in the least. And, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's hard to believe that the, Republican governor can't find time. She's just too busy to see the Republican nominee. I mean, there were 8,000 Republicans, apparently, who showed up for that rally in New Mexico, and she is a representative, and those 8,000 people voted for her. And, you know, she may have differences with Trump, and she may want to deal with those differences and state them publicly. But not stating anything is sort of just, you know, I'm too busy, I don't have time for you. I mean, that's a brush off. I mean, you know, I guess I'm not surprised that he finds that a little offensive.
So really, Lana, you're talking or identifying a bigger problem that's sort of festering under the surface. And so given that, you know, your criticism is well taken, that there's no reason to brush somebody off who's the nominee of the party. But on the other hand, his response to it just inflames the situation further. And I don't know how, you know, you back down from those situations that Trump has a tendency to escalate rather than mediate. So is there, I guess, an adult, you know, somebody that can, like a marriage counselor. Do the Republicans have a marriage counselor, do you think?
They need a therapist.
A therapist, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. They need somebody. I mean, they need something to, you know, I mean, what are people worried about? I mean, people don't know what to do. They're deciding whether, I mean, if you're a candidate, you know, what does it do to me if I support him versus what does it do to me if I don't support him? I mean, it's a lose-lose situation for many Republicans, right? But they really have this situation in front of them. And so they have to confront it. Trump doesn't help the situation by, you know, like you said, sort of just lashing out at people, perhaps these childish plays, really offensive and aggressive, right, maneuvers on his part, the things that he states. But also, you know, these other people have to sort of take some responsibility for their share in that. And, you know, they're Republicans too, and the fact is that a lot of Republicans voted in this contest under these rules, and this is what those rules produced.
Well, clearly the escalation is not being dampened because New Mexico's Governor Susana Martinez has since the Trump rally where he went after her, she's replied today by saying, "I won't be bullied into an endorsement." So it's suggesting perhaps that that's what it's all about, her endorsement. But that leads me to a broader question. And you mentioned some of the criticism that she had leveled at him about his insulting remarks about Mexicans and about women and about building a wall. Who is the onus on to apologize? If you're a minority or a woman and you feel deeply insulted by somebody, is the onus on you to apologize or the onus on the person who insulted you to apologize?
Well, I mean, I don't see why you would be apologize for being insulted. So, you know, I think that Trump needs to take a close look at his positions. I mean, he's no longer a narrow, you know, constituent-driven nominee of the Republican Party, you know, narrow constituency. He's now the party nominee of the whole party. And he needs to think about those crossover voters, and he needs to think about, you know, apologies go a long way in politics, actually, amazingly enough. You know, we seem to move on when people go, "Hey, I made a mistake." At least, you know, a good percentage of the time you can move people from that. So, you know, he's got to find a way to censor himself, which is obviously difficult because that's not his MO. You know, but it's also got to be the Republican Party has got to be there. The leaders of the Republican Party need to step up and provide the leadership to help to create that bridge. And it's not clear to me that sort of not having time for somebody is a way to start that dialogue to get somewhere. You don't have to start a dialogue, Paul Ryan. You don't have to start a dialogue to say, "I'm going to endorse you." You just have to meet with someone. So it seems to me that sort of raised the stakes. And, you know, she doesn't know where she stands yet, but she is the head of the Governors Association. She's sort of the leading governor of all of the Republican governors. She's the lead governor of the state. And so it's a pretty bold statement to say, "I just don't have time." Now, maybe she doesn't want to do the endorsement, but maybe there's some middle ground that these individuals need to come to, right? because this is their nominee. And if they're in a lose-lose situation and they feel that way, they've got to figure out how to make that somehow a lose-win or win-lose situation. And the lack of dialogue and the lack of trying to do something from the inside is going to entice more violence. And it's likely that we're going to see more of these rallies or rally riots across the country.
Well, here in Anaheim in Southern California, there were 17 arrests today, and I think you're right. This is going to probably go on throughout all the way to November, if not escalate. So let me get a sense then of local politics. If the governor has taken this stand and made it clear that she's offended by what Trump has said about Hispanics and about building a wall, etc., her not showing up, if she had shown up, would she be criticized by her constituents?
That's right. There could be that. So she needed to find some middle ground. Maybe I don't have time, but I'll meet with him privately about issues. Mm-hmm. Right? There was no attempt to build a bridge, to build something where she was trying to create some middle ground. Yes, I'm a Republican leader. Yes, a lot of Republicans voted for Trump. Clearly, New Mexican Republicans are also going to be voting for Trump. So she needs to find, and all Republicans who are leaders need to find a line. You know, how do I build this line? How do I look like I'm doing both? And that's difficult, but it's not by just saying, I'm not going to have dialogue, right? A democracy is about dialogue, right? I mean, violence is, the violence is, you know, actually sort of frightening, right? The violence is very frightening because the point of a democracy is to not have violence, that we do these things through the ballot booth, right? This is the point, to not have violence. And so to ensue violence, to increase it by not sort of dealing with the fact that you have this nominee in front of you, what are you going to do? How are you going to resolve that issue? You have to start dealing with these issues.
Well, that's clearly the case, but surely, Lona Atkinson, the fact that Donald Trump has said all of these terrible things that are really hurtful to minorities such as Hispanics, they don't like being called a bunch of drug dealers and rapists.
Absolutely.
And women don't like being belittled and objectified. And
neither do I.
So when we talked earlier about being, you know, the Republican Party needing a therapist, it's almost though, it's kind of, Donald Trump has taken it down to a kindergarten level, and shouldn't somebody put him in the corner, a timeout, until he gets rid of his potty mouth?
Well, that's why you need to talk to him, right? That's why you need to have conversations with him and say, hey, there are these bigger issues with the party that we're dealing with, too. I don't think he's not a stupid person. You know, he's not. Look, he's successfully run for president. Right? I mean, he's had a successful business career. So he apparently has quite a bit of charisma. So it seems to me that the way you resolve this is you do talk. And whether it's a kindergartner or, you know, it's an adult, you have to communicate with them, right? And say, hey, that's not the answer. You can't just spank them, right? We don't agree that spanking is the way to go anymore. So we've got to try some other method. And, you know, there's got to be conversation started. Now, whether that's Trump or whether that's Martinez or whether that's someone else or whether that's all of them, you know, we don't know what phone calls were made behind the scenes. I can't believe there was no discussion between those parties at all, right? So there has to be some sort of movement to a place where it's like, you know, look, if you're going to make these stands, then I'm going to have to come out against you, right? If you're not, you know, or whatever, there's got to be some sort of boundary set by people in order to move to the next step for the party. Otherwise, the party's going to be stuck right here for the rest of the election, and that's going to be a problem for the party and all of the coattail effects that come from the presidency.
Well, curiously enough, Lona Atkinson, the Democrats are actually, Harry Reid is in, as we speak, in the process of doing some counseling and therapy and in direct contact with Senator Bernie Sanders, conveying a lot of disquiet amongst a lot of senior Democrats, and particularly in the Senate and the House, about this prolonged race with Hillary Clinton and whether it's a good idea to keep slugging away, particularly at her, you know, the ultimate irony being that a man who ran against billionaires might help elect a billionaire. But I don't know the details. I'm going to be looking into that tomorrow with a former aide of Harry Reid's. But this is what's going on. And there's also, they're talking about dumping Debbie, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the controversial head of the DNC, who would be presiding over the convention. And she's sort of pretty much despised by the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. So I guess by comparison, I'm suggesting that the Democrats also have their fratricide going on, but at least it seems on the Democratic side, they're trying to handle it.
Yeah, they're at least trying to engage in, like you said, I guess some sort of therapy, some sort of dialogue, maybe some sort of compromise, right? I mean, maybe the Debbie, the DNC, maybe that's some sort of compromise, right? I mean, so it just doesn't seem to me that the Republican Party, with the exception of that single meeting with Paul Ryan, is making the same kinds of step forward. Obviously, this is an outlier in terms of an election year. We've never had an election year like this. It's way out on the tail. It's not normal. So it's sort of impossible to predict at that wage. We're not predicting from the normal curve.
Mm-hmm. But just in closing, to sum up your points, you think it's not so much the responsibility of Trump to rein in his behavior as it is for the Republicans to try and reach out to him.
Well, I think they need to try and reach out to him to build something together. I don't think that, you know, without some interaction, he's not going to be responsive to them. That's clear. So it's not about necessarily, you know, I don't know what the right thing is, you know, from a, you know, social point, who's supposed to do what. You know, I'm thinking about what's the best interests of the party and what's the best interests of Republican candidates in the general election. And they need to come to some understanding together. And like the Democrats, they need to move to a stage where people like Martinez are moving forward with something, right, with some clear indicator. I'm not supporting him. I am supporting him. He's backing off on these things. He feels differently. You know, he can soften his opinions as he moves into the general election. Most candidates do. So there's opportunity right now, you know, to start this movement and to make this change. And, you know, that's not happening, and that's going to continue to plague the Republican Party throughout this election until they come to terms with their nominee.
Well, Lana Atkison, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Lana Atkison, who is a professor and Regents Lecturer in the Political Science Department at the University of New Mexico, where she teaches courses on political behavior, public opinion, and elections. She is also the director of the Center for the Study of Voting, Elections, and Democracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.